Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos, a staff writer at The New Yorker.
And I'm Michael Luo, the editor of NewYorker.com. Hey, Evan.
Hey, Mike.
So, Evan, this felt like a really big week in politics in a lot of ways, historic week. But you're a jaded Washington guy who's been around town. What's your sense of how big of a deal it really was?
I think it was a really big deal because you had this really rare combo of events that were substantive and surprising. You had first the Senate passing the Inflation Reduction Act, which resuscitated Biden's domestic agenda. And then, just within a day, you had the FBI executing a search warrant at Mar-a-Lago, home, of course, of former President Donald Trump. You don't get a combination like that very often.
And we also had the very surreal experience of seeing photos of the bottom of Donald Trump's toilet, little bits of paper with his handwriting and Sharpie on them. I can't get the image out of my head.
It's a hard one to unsee, but it's a reminder of something that may, in fact, turn out to be more important, which is his very eccentric habits of managing presidential records. He was known in the White House for tearing things up, and it said that he flushed them down the toilet, and we saw for the first time images of that. Strange as it sounds, this may turn out to be a matter of genuine public interest. We're going to be talking about all of that. We're also going to be joined by our colleague Susan Glasser, who's just reported on the military generals who stood between the president and the coup on January 6th, and she has an extraordinary piece in The New Yorker this week about that.
Fantastic piece. Let's get to it.
The yeas are 50, the nays are 50. The Senate being equally divided, the vice president votes in the affirmative, and the bill, as amended, is passed.
So, Evan, this week the Senate passed the Inflation Reduction Act, a major piece of legislation that has provisions that fight climate change and some significant measures to reduce healthcare costs. The bill includes proposals that everyone in Washington assumed were dead and buried. How did the Democrats do it?
Yeah, I think this caught a lot of people by surprise. It actually sort of reminds me of the old Hemingway line about bankruptcy. It happened gradually and then all of a sudden, because in this context, it meant that you had months and months of frustration, but also compromise. And then you had, at the end, what I might call productive anger. Basically, it looked as if this thing was really dead. You had climate activists who were calling for major investments in new clean energy. And then you had conservative Democrats who said no because of taxes or because of industries. And in the end, when it looked like it was really going to be a debacle, it forced the key players to boil down their demands to the essential pieces. And one of them was authorizing Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs. This is a big deal, something Democrats have talked about for a very long time. There was a study done not long ago that showed that pharmaceutical companies have raised prescription drug prices at nearly four times the rate of inflation between 2016 and 2020, so it has a real impact on people's lives. And then the main event in this bill, of course, was nearly $400 billion in tax breaks over clean energy, which will mean something like a 40% reduction in carbon emissions by the end of this decade from 2005 levels. It's not quite as much as the White House was hoping for, but I think by any definition, it really is momentous. Our colleague John Cassidy this week called it a historic move in the right direction. I think that's certainly the case. And in the end, if you had to isolate one person, Mike, who was at the core of this, it is the name that we have come to hear so often in Washington and around this country, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who finally signed on to the deal.
Evan, you are a professional Manchin watcher. You profiled him last year for the magazine. What do you make of what he did here? Should we be calling him a hero? Will historians say he was the man who saved the earth?
I don't think so. I think he will be the guy who held out long enough that eventually he could climb onto the shoulders of people who really were determined to save the earth and have been working on it for a very long time. And that means he got a prime spot at the top of the pyramid. The key thing to remember about Joe Manchin and his mindset is that he is, in the end, the quarterback at West Virginia University. It's how he sees himself. You know, it's what he was as a teenager. And what that means is he likes being at the center of the action. And it also means he feels deeply, kind of umbilically connected to that state. And that means he was never going to sign on to a deal that did not deliver for some of the most powerful interests in his state. That means coal, principally. It's where he's made his fortune. And then also, he's very close to the oil and gas industries. And so this deal, in the end, was a combination of both huge investments in combating climate change, but it also did it in a way that did not close the door on fossil fuels so abruptly that Joe Manchin couldn't defend it. I think the question for a lot of Democrats now, and I pose this to you, Mike, is what are the implications now going forward politically? Do you think this has meaning for the midterms that are just a couple of months away?
Yeah, I mean, I confess that we in the media, in part to sort of fill column inches in space, like we like to think about it in terms of horse race. And we think about, oh, Joe Biden got his mojo back. And this is a really big deal for the midterms and the campaigns. But I'm a little skeptical of that. Obviously, we're going to need to see some polling numbers and things like that. But the thing I keep going back to is, have the fundamentals changed? You know, we got some numbers today about how inflation's going down a little bit. Jobs numbers are decent. You know, those are the things that are going to matter. Actually, some of the things that have been sort of wins over the last couple of weeks, you know, we obviously had this gun control bill. That was a big deal. But is in the end kind of a little bit marginal. I mean, it's a big deal because, like, Washington can't pass gun control legislation, and this was a piece of gun control legislation, but it was essentially incentivizing states to set up these red flag laws. There was another big piece of legislation relating to incentivizing semiconductor computer chip manufacturing, which is a big deal, but it doesn't exactly roll off your tongue. I think it will help, you know, in terms of, you need something to talk about. You need something to campaign on and to brag about. But in the end, I really do feel like politics is about image. It's about what people sort of are feeling. And some of these things, I think, are kind of baked in.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there are a lot of pieces of the midterm elections, which are just a couple of months away, that are already baked in. People have made their judgments. But I think picking up on something you said that I think is actually really important for the medium term is that many of those recent bills, a surprising number of them, have actually been bipartisan. I mean, the CHIPS Act, which is about encouraging the manufacture of semiconductors, the Veterans Benefits Bill, which is going to help people who were affected by the burning of toxic material on military bases, and then the gun control bill that you mentioned. It's kind of amazing. At a time of extraordinary hyperpartisanship, you still got three bipartisan bills. And I think in some basic way, that leaches into the groundwater, and it makes it harder for people who want to say the Democratic Party has gone too far out to the left and I no longer recognize myself in it. So that may actually help them in places down the line that they're trying to cultivate, which is that elusive voter in the middle. All right, moving on.
There's breaking news out of Palm Beach, Florida. Former President Trump says his Mar-a-Lago home there is being raided by the FBI right now.
We have to talk about the other big news this week, Mike, which of course was the search warrant that was executed at Mar-a-Lago. Trump seems to have a way of getting himself back into the news cycle, even if he might not have preferred to do it this way. By most accounts, it seems that the search had something to do with the handling of presidential records, what it is that has or has not been handed over to the National Archives. It's a subject you happen to know a lot about. What do you make of this search and the role that records may have played in it?
Yeah, I'm a records nerd, and I love the National Archives. There's extraordinary records, including presidential records that you can go back to, letters, diary entries, documents. It's a true sort of treasure of American democracy. The thing about it, though, is I can't help but think that this can't be just about, you know, those kinds of records that I associate with the National Archives. It can't be about innocuous things, I feel like. I mean, we know that this was a really sensitive move by the Justice Department. This had to have been approved at the highest levels by Merrick Garland himself. And there was some reporting that Trump's lawyers actually met with an official with the Counterintelligence and Export Control section of the Justice Department. And that sounds, you know, quite serious. And the thing that I go to is, were there things there that, you know, maybe were a danger to national security that he kept his hands on?
So in effect, saying it's not just the fact that he had these records, but it appears that it may be that there's something that's in those records that was of such specific nature that that would have prompted such an extraordinary move?
That's what I think some people have been theorizing and speculating about. But really, you know, Evan, we are responsible journalists. We work for The New Yorker. We don't like to speculate. And so we really should talk about concrete, tangible things. And one of those is the Republican response to this. We've known, obviously, for some time that the Republican Party remains in Donald Trump's thrall. But Evan, have you been surprised by the rhetoric that we're hearing from top Republicans after this?
I have, actually, Mike. There are a lot of ways that you could respond to the news that the former president was getting the visit by the FBI. You could have said, I want to wait and see what the facts say. You could have said, nobody's above the law. And that is not at all what we're hearing from leaders on the Republican side. It's just quite extraordinary. I mean, Kevin McCarthy has already said, in effect, that he's going to, if he becomes House Speaker, that they would be convening hearings, that Merrick Garland should clear his schedule. I am actually most struck by a story in Politico. Somebody close to former President Trump said that the raid by the FBI would now become, as this person put it, the juice for his political agenda. That's an extraordinary statement because it means, no, we're not putting issues at the center. We're not putting questions of what we can achieve in politics. We're actually talking about putting this question of whether or not this president committed a crime and how it was investigated. We're putting that at the center of his political agenda. So look, I think this is a week that is providing an x-ray of these two parties. And you've got one party that is saying very clearly, we are doing everything we can to wrap ourselves in the flag of Donald J. Trump. I'm curious what you make of that. What do you think this does to his political ambitions in the short run and his political prospects down the line?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the same things that you've seen, Evan, that that Trump seems to believe that this is going to help him. And that's really frightening and depressing if it really is true that doubling down on kind of civil war talk is really what we're seeing, is where we're seeing this kind of bellicosity. You know, you're also seeing Republicans talking about defunding the FBI and, you know, all of that could very well have sealed the Republican nomination for Donald Trump. Maybe now this is the week that Ron DeSantis lost his chance of becoming the Republican nominee. But I guess I go back to the fact that, you know, Trump's approval ratings have been kind of stuck in this 38% sort of range, you know, and that's why he lost the 2020 election by a large margin. And I just don't understand how doubling down on something like this, Republicans going all in on this, how does that actually broaden his coalition?
Mm-hmm. Mike, you're describing a campaign based on grievance, the idea of Donald Trump's grievances with the FBI and with others. That is a theme, in fact, that also runs through this extraordinary story in The New Yorker this week by Susan Glasser about Donald Trump's relationship to his military generals leading up to January 6th. And we're going to have her on in just a minute, right after this break.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, we're back. I'm Evan Osnos.
And I'm Michael Luo.
In this week's magazine, Susan Glasser and Peter Baker have written a story that is full of jaw-dropping details about a key aspect of the Trump era, his antagonism with the military, and specifically the generals, throughout his presidency, leading right up to the dramatic final days before January 6th. And Susan is with us now. Hi, Susan. Welcome back.
Hi there. Thanks so much, guys.
Reading over your piece, Susan, I found it kind of staggering how many generals were actually fired from various posts over the course of Trump's presidency. Can you remind us who the main characters are in this saga?
Yeah, I mean, look, Donald Trump came in to office in 2017, and he had this vision, I think, of the military and of his own role in it, perhaps because he, you know, had been sent off to military school when he was a kid by his father, never served, of course, in the military, famously alleged to have had various bone spurs that somehow kept him from Vietnam. But Donald Trump had this idea of what he called my generals on the very first day of his presidency, the day of his inauguration, and he appointed them to key positions initially. So you had his second chief of staff, John Kelly, was a retired four-star Marine general. You had, of course, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, whom he had inherited from the Obama era, four-star Marine General Joseph Dunford. You had H.R. McMaster, his second of four national security advisors, an Army general. Those were key players, along with Jim Mattis, the defense secretary initially in the Trump administration, another retired four-star Marine general. Mattis, Kelly, and Dunford were extremely close. In some ways, this Marine fraternity supervised national security policy in the first couple of years of the Trump presidency. But of course, he had made a mistake because they weren't really his generals, and they never were. And he soon came to chafe at what he understood belatedly to be really a warrior caste that was utterly different than the sort of salute and say yes, sir, to whatever orders he threw at them.
Much of your story, Susan, focuses on Mark Milley, who is still the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's really a fascinating character. He was going to resign. One of your great many scoops in your story is his actual resignation letter. But then he decided not to, and he drew up this plan to stay on the job. As far as I can tell, the goal was to basically try not to start a nuclear war and maintain his own integrity. Do you think he succeeded in doing that?
That's going to be for history to judge in some way, Mike. But I have to say, so Mark Milley, he's brought in by Donald Trump because Trump tires of Joe Dunford, the almost cerebral, very quiet, filled with integrity Marine general who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. People whispering in Trump's ear say, no, you'll like this guy Milley better. Milley is a four-star Army general, a very different character in many ways. Milley is loquacious, talkative, blunt. In some ways, maybe he was a better fit for Donald Trump, except, of course, that Donald Trump really didn't understand him any better than he understood the Marines. He also, I think, thought that he had his own handpicked chairman who was just going to do what he wanted. And, of course, this moment of crisis comes. It's after the June 1st, 2020 infamous Lafayette Square photo op in which Donald Trump seeks to project an image of strength in quelling the Black Lives Matter protests that erupt around the country after the killing of George Floyd. And Milley, unbeknownst to him what it was for, is called to the White House. He's wearing his combat fatigues, and he marches in that photo op. He actually peels off halfway through. But of course, no one remembers that. What they remember is they saw on live television this horrific image. And I was one of the many, many people at the time who tweeted like, oh my God, look at Trump has now politicized the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He's using the military as a prop. And Milley gets this incredible blowback. He understands clearly he's screwed up. He would later refer to it with others as his road to Damascus moment. He considers resigning, agonizes over that, consults widely. I spoke with a number of the people who spoke with him in the days following that. So they urged him and Mark Esper, the defense secretary, to stay, in part because if then they were confronting Trump over what they considered to be illegal or unconstitutional matters, that then Trump would be forced to fire them and it would be clear, you know, that they were trying to do the right thing. So they decided to stay and fight. But there's a big controversy over that, to your question of, like, was it the right thing in the end? You know, I've been interested to watch the debate play out about General Milley and his actions. But, you know, I have to say, when I did this reporting, I came away feeling like it's not their job to give press conferences, someone like this. Our nation's national security establishment, their job is to play it straight. And if they think the president of the United States is a threat to national security, there's no handbook for these people. It doesn't say what to do in the Constitution.
Yeah, that is one of the things that comes through, is that, like so much we discovered during the Trump presidency, a lot of this rests on traditions, on norms, on kind of expectations, on what is done and what is not done. And Trump, it seems from your reporting, thought he could get in there and muscle the generals into compliance, into submission, into helping him achieve the kind of pomp that he wanted. And yet, with the exception of Michael Flynn, of course, really almost to a person, they resisted, they rebuffed, they tried to rebel internally. Why is that, do you think, in the end, that they were able to reject what he was trying to do?
You know, Evan, it's interesting. I mean, I have not spent a career amongst the generals, if you will, you know, reporting. And I found this to be probably the most unsettling reporting I'd ever done that I can think of. But also, I heard very similar things, even from very senior officials in our government who didn't like each other very much. You know, there's a lot of politics behind the screen at the Pentagon. But what I was really fascinated by was that even across those rivalries and disagreements, and there were profound disagreements, by the way, about whether and how to confront Trump and in what ways to do so. But even with those disagreements, there's more that united those officers than not. In the course of the reporting, I heard very similar sentiments about, we're all the same. We generals, you know, Trump thinks that Milley is a Trump general. He is wrong. And, you know, they might second guess some of Milley's actions. But in fact, they all told me, you know, you can knock him down and there's 10 more who will stand up to take his place, who will think the exact same thing. Independent, nonpartisan military is a religion for these people. The Constitution is their Bible. And, you know, it's not Trump's Bible. And I think that's why the language is so impassioned in the draft resignation letter that we obtained and published in this, because, you know, it clearly speaks to someone whose profoundest principles have been offended by Donald Trump.
Susan, it's a heated competition, but the passage that probably was tweeted the most in your story was the Hitler's generals line, this exchange that occurred between Trump and Kelly, with Trump asking why his generals can't be as loyal as Hitler's generals. How do you parse even a statement like that coming from the president of the United States? It's just completely shocking.
You know, it really is. And I think it's a measure of our collective need to somehow, at a very disturbing moment in American politics, to retain our capability for shock and horror. So this was a confrontation that occurred early on in the presidency between John Kelly, his chief of staff, his second chief of staff, and Donald Trump. And Trump basically says, you fucking generals, you know, how come you're not like the German generals? And, you know, Kelly, like any of us would have, you know, says, what are you talking about? You know, what do you mean? You know, and Trump says, yeah, like in World War II, I mean, you know, they were totally loyal to Hitler. And first of all, obviously he's wrong on the facts there. And, you know, Kelly tries to say that, like, no, they tried to kill Hitler three times. But of course, the bigger picture is not an argument over the factual assertion, but the mere concept, you know, that the president of the United States would see, you know, a fascist totalitarian army as the right model. And, you know, Milley's resignation letter gives an echo of that, right? So he talks about in there that you seem to even subscribe to many of the principles that we fought against in World War II, and when we fought against fascism and Nazism. And, you know, yeah. I mean, Milley wasn't in the room with Trump and John Kelly in that encounter. Kelly, by the way, has subsequently gone on the record and agreed that that is a story that really happened to him. He talked about that with NBC News after our article came out. And, you know, obviously I've been working on this article and maybe you get a little bit inured. And I was describing this extraordinary exchange to someone, a very, you know, senior Pentagon official the other day. And you know, he gasped audibly. Mm. And, you know, I realized like, wow. Okay. So this is something that still has the capacity to shock. I think the response when the article came out, and you know what, in some ways, like, yes. I mean, if this isn't shocking, then truly nothing is.
There is a moment in your story and in the history of this period that is the climax, really, of his attempts to try to satisfy his fantasy of what the military could be for his leadership. That, of course, was after he lost the 2020 election. And at that point, he began to make a bunch of moves in the civilian leadership at the Department of Defense. What was the goal, from what you can tell, and how close did he come to achieving it?
Well, this is, I think, a live action target, if you will, Evan, and obviously a very important question. So why did Donald Trump fire the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, on the very first workday after the election was called for him? Certainly, one can see now, especially that more evidence has become public, thanks to the January 6th committee and other investigations, that suggests that this was, in fact, connected with a plan to use the machinery of the Pentagon and the Defense Department in service of his efforts to overturn the election.
Was the goal, do you think, to use the military to seize voting machines, or was it something else?
Well, it seems that there were multiple goals, right? You know, including policy goals. So one of the things that Trump and his small circle of loyalists at the end wanted to make sure is that they checked off the box. They wanted to, quote, end the endless wars. In fact, 2 days after Esper was fired, this order comes over from the White House to immediately pull out of Afghanistan willy-nilly, no planning, nothing, immediately pull troops out of Africa where they were on a counterterrorism mission in Somalia. And it was a rogue operation. Even the National Security Advisor didn't know about it. And they stopped that, but only in an extraordinary series of events. So that was part of the goal. But to the question of were they contemplating using the military in the effort to overturn the election results, your rational self wants to say, no way, that's crazy. But in fact, the record that's still being assembled suggests that they were considering doing so, including at an incredible Oval Office meeting on December 18th, 2020, in which Mike Flynn, the former National Security Advisor of Trump, who had just been pardoned by Trump, he and Sidney Powell of, I think, much fame at this point, the lawyer, they brought with them a draft presidential order that would use the military to seize voting machines. And Donald Trump didn't throw them out of his office. He didn't call up the FBI and say, you know, get these lunatics out of here. He spent 5 hours discussing the idea with them. A president, for the first time really in American history, is seriously contemplating what amounts to a declaration of martial law in his effort to overturn a presidential election. And, you know, I'm sure the investigations, plural, continue on exactly this question of how close did we actually come to some form of martial law.
So much of the story, Susan, is about what's going on in the White House and in the agencies at the top of Republican politics. I'm curious if you did find out anything interesting about what the Democrats were doing in this time. Did you ever find anybody who sensed where things were going, was doing anything that might have tried to arrest the slide or, you know, introduce or raise the alarms? Or was it really a case of this all going on behind the scenes until it burst out into the open?
Yeah, Evan, that's such a good question. So in the immediate aftermath of Lafayette Square in June of 2020, Milley was very contrite and reached out to senior Democrats on Capitol Hill and elsewhere to assure them that, you know, he knew that he had screwed up and that there, you know, there was no way, no how he was going to let the military be misused in any Trump power grab or effort to, you know, politicize and weaponize the military against Americans for the next few months until the election or after the election. And so, you know, he sent that message pretty clearly to Nancy Pelosi, to Chuck Schumer, to other leading Democrats. And, you know, that message was received after the election when Biden was declared the winner. You know, Milley was personally engaging with senior officials from the Biden transition team at a time when the Trump administration was refusing to follow the law and to, you know, undertake a normal transition of government, which is largely to make sure that our national security is protected. You know, in fact, as the piece reports, Milley was sitting in his office on January 6th with Christine Wormuth, who was the senior, the lead Biden transition official for the Pentagon. She's subsequently been nominated for and become the Secretary of the Army in the Biden administration. But she's sitting there, you know, doing her job with Milley, and they're talking about, you know, the transition when they see this horror show unfold on the television screen in front of them.
Susan, so many of these people who went to work for Trump thought they could be this axis of adults who could control him, but they ended up often being burned. Do you think there's a larger lesson here? There's actually going to be a lot of people out there who are thinking about, you know, should they accept this offer to work for a Trump campaign? And their Republican politicians out there continue are actually seem to be increasingly extreme in putting them in the Trump sort of mode. And there's this decision point that people have to make. What should we take away from the experiences of these axis of adults and what they went through?
You know, Mike, that is in many ways kind of one of the biggest and unresolved running themes of anyone who's trying to think or write about the Trump presidency. I think, you know, in our book, The Divider, that's literally from day one, is this ambiguity. First of all, of course, the testimony about Trump and his erratic, disruptive presidency. Who does it come from? The testimony comes from inside the room, right? It comes from people, therefore, who were willing to work for Donald Trump on the front end, right? These are flawed actors. And part of the story, of course, is how their misjudgments or mistakes or their feuds with each other come to maybe make Donald Trump stronger in some ways than he might have been. That definitely is a theme that we pick up on with some of the military types, like you know, the feuding between H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis. Like, you know, in the end, right, Donald Trump benefits, right? He has a sort of divide and conquer, almost natural instinct. And of course, that empowers him in some important way. However, I will say that what I also found, you know, ambiguous, because life is ambiguous. And, you know, I know in this polarized world, right, people want us to present them with a neat story of like, here's a hero, here's a villain, like, oh, how evil. No, you know, like everybody's evil who worked for Donald Trump. Okay, clearly these are all flawed characters. But think about January 6th, right? You know, there is a pretty obvious historically documented difference, right, between John Kelly and Mark Meadows, the second chief of staff and the fourth chief of staff. We can't say for sure, but it's the record suggests pretty strongly that John Kelly would have thrown himself in front of a bus rather than let January 6th occur. And it's also clear that Mark Meadows, you know, was one of its chief facilitators.
That brings me to our final question, Susan, is exactly to that point, which is that so much of the work that you've done in Washington and in this piece and for the book really brilliantly captures the role of individuals and the tension with institutions. I think so many of us, as we look back on the Trump era, struggle with this core question, which is, were we ultimately protected from the worst possible consequences by the acts of individuals or by the kind of underlying tensile strength of institutions. And I'm curious, as you think about the role of the military, what's the answer?
You know, I do think that the Trump years were a four-year exercise in showing us not only the incredible flaws of individuals, and Donald Trump has an incredible, almost like a homing beacon for, you know, broken and flawed individuals who he could control in that way, but also weaknesses in our institutions that we never even knew existed. Here we are still talking about the Electoral Count Act of the 1870s as a result of Donald Trump's probing and probing and probing for weaknesses. And, you know, there was a lot of what I would say is self-soothing by Democrats and critics of Donald Trump over the 4 years, instead of saying like, well, the institutions held, well, it's not so bad. Like, really? I feel like, you know, at this point, it's hard to come away with that as your takeaway. The institutions are only as good as the individuals who serve in them. And Donald Trump, you know, one of his kind of malign superpowers is his ability to not care and to keep going and keep going and keep going in the face of constraints that would stop others from moving forward. And so in that context, you have to look at the actions of those who surrounded him. I remember Elliot Cohen, who's one of the leading Never Trumpers. He's a Republican, a big Pentagon expert, actually. He said to me at the very beginning of the Trump presidency, he said, you know, Susan, you'll hear a lot of like people saying, oh, no one will work for Donald Trump. He said, don't waste your time on that. Okay, America's a big country. Donald Trump will surround himself with people, and he will, over time, find a way to get a cadre of loyalists, and he will test these institutions, and it may take him time, but he will break them. And, you know, Elliot Cohen said that to me, and I will never forget it, in early 2017, and he was right.
Well, you have helped us understand him. Susan Glasser, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
You can read Susan Glasser and Peter Baker's story, Inside the War Between Trump and His Generals, at newyorker.com. And be sure to pre-order their book, The Divider, The Trump White House 2017 to 2021, which is coming out September 20th.
This has been The Political Scene. The show is produced by Michelle Moses and Kylie Warner. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. I'm Evan Osnos.
And I'm Mike Luo.
Thanks for listening.